And this guy sitting right next to me lifts his hand up to his wrist, up to his mouth, and starts speaking into his wrist. Have you seen these new like phones you get implanted on your skin that you talk into? I thought, you've got to be kidding me. So I turned and asked him about it. I said, where did you get this? And he was really rude. He's like, don't worry about it. I'm on the phone, you know, back off. I was like, fine. Well, I had to go to the bathroom. I asked him to wash my bags. I came back and I had toilet paper dangling down from my ear. He looked at me. He goes, what is that? I said, don't worry about it. I'm getting a fax. All right, we are in the home stretch here. And this last session is going to be very, very important because we haven't yet talked about how we know the Bible in itself is really true. Let me just give you a little bit of encouragement here. We're going to probably spend 30 minutes looking at how we know the Bible's true. Do you know how many books are written on this and how many classes could be taught? We're going to scratch the surface. Why? Because I want you to have the confidence and know that behind your belief in the Bible, there's really good reason to think that it's true. But there's no way you can sit here and listen to me for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, talk, answer questions, and walk out here and have answers to all your questions about the Bible. It just doesn't work that way. Besides, I've been doing this for a lot longer than probably many of you have been alive, thinking about this stuff, studying it. So to share your faith with somebody, you don't have to have all the answers. My point in doing this and playing the atheist role play is not so you walk out here and go, okay, boy, I can't talk to any atheist until I can answer every conceivable question. If you do that, you will never talk to any non-believers. Look, you pick up the simple book, More Than a Carpenter, and read it, you already know more than most people, Christians or non-Christians, know about God. Okay? So the point of this is not to think, oh my goodness, I have to buy 800 books. I have to study 40 hours a week for the next 15 years, then I can share my faith. A lot of people share their faith by just talking about what Jesus has done in their life and sharing scripture from the Bible. That's fine. But I want to encourage you on top of that to start making a part of your life, just going a little bit deeper, finding answers one at a time. And as you learn more, your confidence will develop. And you'll be able to help other people more when their questions come up. Okay? So don't think before you share your faith, you have to have an answer for everything, because I don't even come close to have an answer for everything like your pastor does here. Okay? He's the exception. All right. Well, here's the deal. How do we actually know the Bible's true? I won't do this because of time. Sometimes I go around and I hold a microphone to people and ask them how they know the Bible's true. And rarely can a Christian even give me an intelligent reason why we know the Bible's true. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to look at the Bible as a historical document in the way that we would look at any other ancient document. Okay? So if we're going to look at the writings of Plato or the ancient writings of Aristotle or Thucydides, we would ask certain historical questions to see if we have reason to believe that they are giving us an accurate account. We're going to do the same thing with the Bible. I believe it's the inspired, inerrant word of God because I'm a Christian. But to show this to a non-Christian, we don't have to assume that all that's true. We just look at the Bible through the lens of how history approaches it. And I think you'll be amazed at how the Bible is set apart from all other ancient books. So the way it works is we're going to look at three tests, so to speak, that historians apply to ancient documents. One is called the honesty test, and we're simply asking the question, do we have reason to believe, we're really going to focus on the New Testament and really the Gospels. Do we have reason to believe that the writers are being honest and care about the truth? Excuse me. Second is called the telephone test. Who in here has played the telephone game at some point in your life? A message gets passed along. Well, the Bible is written 2,000 years ago. How do we know the message hasn't been changed as it went from one person to the next? And then last, the corroboration test. Is there any corroborative evidence outside the Bible that supports the stories within the Bible? That's it. And then we'll take some questions. So I invite you to listen carefully, listen critically, see what questions or challenges you might have, and we'll wrap it up with that question and answer time. Okay? So let's jump into the first one, the honesty test. And the first question is, does the document claim to be reporting the truth? does the document actually claim that it's truth, or does it claim to be a fable, or does it claim to be a myth? Well, when you open up the New Testament and the Gospels, I don't know if you've noticed this, but over and over again, the writers go out of their way to make sure that we know that they care about truth. So Luke, by the way, what was Luke's profession? He was a doctor. He was a physician. Look at how Luke, an educated man, begins his gospel. In Luke 1, he says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those from the first who were what? Eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Since I myself have what? Carefully investigated everything in the beginning, it seemed good to me also to write an orderly account so you may know the certainty of things you have been taught. Does this sound like somebody who's careful? Does this sound like someone who cares about the facts? Sometimes people will respond to me and they'll say, well, the Bible is just a bunch of myths and it's stories that were made up. Look at what Peter writes in 2 Peter 1:16. We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were what? We were eyewitnesses. And I want you to notice John. When John begins the letter of 1 John, notice how many of the five senses are involved here. Look at what he says. He says, what was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have looked at, what we have touched with our hands, he says, we proclaim to you. How many senses are involved? He's saying, but this isn't just some myth someone told us. We saw it, we heard it, and we touched the living Jesus with our own hands. Now, this is just the beginning, but if you read the New Testament through this lens, you'll notice over and over again, they're saying, we were there, we are eyewitnesses, we saw it, we're carefully investigating this, truth matters. So when it comes to honesty, at least on the surface, it sure seems like it's people that are concerned with truth. Now, let me ask you another question. How do many fairy tales begin? What do they often say? Once upon a time, in a land far, far away, or in another galaxy far, far away, right? When in a galaxy far, far away, not another one, I'm sorry. The Star Wars fans are like, you butchered it. I think I heard Bill O'Reilly on Fox News talking about Star Wars, and then he quoted someone from Star Trek. I thought, oh man, he's going to get some emails. That was not a good move. Well, when fictional stories like this are made up, let me ask you a question. If somebody was inventing a story from the past that was not true, would they give a whole bunch of details that you could check out, or would they leave it very vague? What would they do? They'd leave it vague, right? So if somebody is telling, it's like a witness who's brought in to testify, they give very general information. But when a witness is giving very detailed information, you think, boy, this person really remembers and we can check this out. Well, look at what Luke does in chapter 3. I want you to notice the precision. Luke says, now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, not the 10th year, not the 14th, not the 18th, not the 20th, the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, not Julius Caesar, not Augustus Caesar, Tiberius Caesar. He says, when Pontius Pilate, of all the governors, Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, and Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip was tetrarch of the reign of Iturea. Then he talks about the coming of Jesus. Do you see what Luke does? He's not saying in a land far, far away, there once was a king who was born of a virgin. He doesn't say that. He says in this year, during this time, with these rulers in this place, and guess what historians have done? They've gone and checked that out, and that's exactly what they find. So you see what's going on? The writers say we investigate things, we're careful, we're eyewitnesses, but then they give a lot of details, specific details, that can actually be checked out. But then there's something else in the New Testament and the Gospels that has always given me a sense that I can trust these writings. Now, I have a friend who's a cold case detective. That's what he does for a living. He just convicted a man of murdering his wife over 30 years ago. And at the very end, the guy turns to his lawyer. He didn't know his microphone was on. He goes, they got me. I'm going to confess. And the microphone was on. It went out to everybody. So they got him. It was kind of a funny moment, but he was going to confess anyways. Well, he told me, he said, there's an interesting way you can know if a witness is telling the truth. He said, you see, when people make up lies, why do humans lie? Because why? We want to get out of trouble, or we want to look what? We want to look good to somebody, right? Is it human nature to make up a lie to make ourselves look bad? Does this ring true with the way humans act? You're on a date? Yeah. You know, let me tell you my most embarrassing story to make myself look like an idiot that didn't even happen. Not really going to happen, right? So here's what historians do. When they read ancient documents, if they find that the writer includes material that is embarrassing to the writer, then the historians say, oh, that writer cares about truth because they're willing to share something even if it disparages his own character. Does that make sense? It's like a witness on a stand. If they share information that looks bad to themselves, then the jury goes, boy, this person's really sharing the truth even though they screwed up. We can trust them as a witness. Well, when you look at the New Testament, do the disciples look very favorable or do they look kind of bad, so to speak? Is that an understatement? Can you think of any embarrassing things that the disciples did? Peter denies Christ, right? Now, don't put them up there yet. Okay, good. Yeah, does the document contain embarrassing material? What other embarrassing things? Just think of any story in the Gospels, and they're basically embarrassing. Peter lacks faith when he's walking on water, right? What else? James and John are fighting over who's the greatest disciple. And Jesus says, what's the matter with you guys? Think of any more?
James and John asking Jesus to call thunder.
Yeah, they're like, send thunder down and burn these people up. And Jesus is like, whoa, chill out. What's the matter with you guys? Okay. Peter cut off Malchus's ear and Jesus is like, stop, put your sword away. What's the matter with you? In the Garden of Gethsemane, the night Jesus is getting arrested, he says, stay awake 3 times. And they fall asleep. See, here's some, and you got a bunch of them, but look, throw some of these up here for me. Number one, Peter denies Jesus. Jesus calls Peter Satan. That wasn't like a joke, like, oh, your mom a joke. Oh, yeah, Jesus called Peter Satan. This was like the worst thing he could say. Third, throw it up there for me. James and John want to reign with Jesus. You got that one. And show the next slide. There's a couple more. The disciples many times don't even understand the teachings of Jesus. Jesus teaches the parable of the sower. And what do the disciples say? They say, hey, Jesus, let us help you with your illustration. Here's how you could be a better communicator and more effective. Do they say that? Of course not. What do they say? They go, Jesus, we don't get it. And Jesus says, you guys are idiots. That's my California translation. They don't even understand when Jesus teaches stuff. And last, who discovered the empty tomb but women? Do you know how embarrassing this would be? When Jesus arrested, all the disciples flee except possibly John. Peter denies him. The women go to the tomb. The women go to anoint the body, and the women see the tomb that's empty and the angel that's there. Do you know in that culture, a woman's testimony was worthless in a court of law? She couldn't even testify. So let me ask you something. If the disciples are making up a story that's not true, who do you think is the last people the disciples would have invented to discover the empty tomb? Women. Can you see the disciples sitting around going, all right, let's tell a story that'll convince people Jesus is risen. I know, I got it. Peter says, let's say we all fled and were cowards. Let's add that I cut off a guy's ear and denied Jesus 3 times, and let's make women the heroes. Do you know any men in the history of the world that would do this? Of course not. So what does that tell me when I read that women discovered the empty tomb? I say, oh, these disciples are willing to report embarrassing material because they are most concerned about truth. You see the way this works? We're trying to ask the question, do we have reason to think that the disciples are honest? Number one, they say, we didn't invent this. We saw it. We heard it. We were eyewitnesses. We investigated. Then they give particular details that can be investigated. And then they share embarrassing material. So if you were a jury examining these people, you'd say, wait a minute, this has the ring of truth about it. But the last thing the disciples did for their belief that they had seen the risen Jesus is one of the most compelling reasons to me that I can trust their testimony. That all of them were willing to suffer for their beliefs. And many of them, in fact, died as martyrs for their faith. In fact, according to church tradition, this is what it says. It tells us that Peter was crucified, Andrew was crucified, Philip was crucified, Bartholomew flayed to death, James the Greater beheaded, Matthew killed with a sword, Matthias stoned, and that doesn't mean they gave him a bunch of marijuana and said, smoke this until you die. That only happens in Colorado. Thomas was stabbed with spears, John died after exile, Luke hanged, James the Just thrown and beaten, Mark dragged to death by horse, and Paul beheaded. Now, I'm actually doing my PhD dissertation on this right now, and I think some of those we can know historically are solid. Some of them are little later accounts that I'm not quite sure of, but I'll tell you what we know. We know they were eyewitnesses of the risen Jesus. We know they willingly proclaimed in the face of persecution. They saw their friends dying, and we have no record of them recanting and walking away. That tells me that they really believed they had seen the risen Jesus, and that I can trust their testimony. So when we look at this book and we look at the Bible and we're saying in the New Testament, do I have reason to think that it's true? I don't know what else these writers could have done to persuade us that they are at least being honest and reporting the facts as they stand. And let me give you a little hint. My friend who's a cold case detective told me that in every case he's worked for 25 years, they always come down to one of three things. In other words, why do people commit murder? Why do they commit theft, kidnapping? One of three things, either power, money, or lust related to sex. It all comes down to power, sex, and money. Well, you look at the disciples, was it about power? No, in fact, what did Jesus teach? If you want to serve, you got to be willing. If you want to lead, you got to be willing to serve. It wasn't about power. Was it about money? They didn't get any money for this, that's for sure. Was it about sex and getting women? Are you kidding me? Many of them were not even married. Of course, there's no indication that they were in it for that reason. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'll contrast that with Mormonism. And these are just facts. This is not to disparage Mormonism. But you look at Joseph Smith, who made some radical claims about Jesus. Power? He had the largest militia outside of the U.S. military at one point in his life, and he wanted to be president. Sex, he had at least 33 wives. Money, he started his own bank that he was personally in charge of until it went broke. I don't see the signs that I should trust him as a credible witness that I do see when I look at the disciple writers. Joseph Smith was not martyred in the way that they tell the story. He went down killing people in a very different way than the disciples did. Do we have reason to believe they passed the honesty test? I think we do. Now let's look at the second one, which we call the telephone test. Now we're asking a different question. So we say, all right, we have reason to believe that these writers care about truth and they're honest. How do we know the Bible's been passed faithfully from generation to generation? Now, this is like the telephone game. If you guys ever like sent a text or a Facebook message, and the moment you hit send, you kind of wish you could reach into cyberspace and take it back. I was on a plane not too long ago, and I saw a buddy of mine. I didn't know we're on the same plane. And when we're debarking, I see him like 10 or 15 rows in front of me. And he's pulling his bag down. I'm like, oh man, I want to catch up with my buddy. So I sent him a text. I said, hey punk, turn around. I'm right behind you. And I sent it to my mom, who is home alone reading at night. Fortunately, my mom has a good sense of humor. She texted me back. She said, hey, son, I think you've got the wrong punk. See, here's what happens in communication. You have a person who's sending a message. You have the medium through which the message is sent, and then you have the receiver. Even sometimes with all our technology today, messages get messed up or they get changed, don't they? How do we know that this book, written 2,000 years ago, hasn't been changed from generation to generation to generation? How do we know we can hold in our hands what was originally written down? So like the telephone game, has it been passed as it went from one person to the next? Well, this is what certain historians by the name of textual critics do, is they try to reconstruct original documents to see how much confidence we can have that we have the originals. Does that make sense? There's a whole discipline involved in trying to reconstruct the originals. And these are the questions that they ask. So the next one up here. First thing they say is, what is the time gap between the original copies and the copies we have today? So in other words, how much time has passed from when this was written and a remaining existent copy that we have? So you tell me, do we want a big time gap or a small time gap? Small. If you play the telephone game with three people, you have a pretty good chance of getting it through. If we play a telephone game with all 80 people in this row, good luck with that, right? So the smaller the time gap, the better chance we have of reconstructing the original. Now, here's what it looks like. The biblical manuscripts were actually written on scrolls that would unroll sideways like this. And they would have an original that was penned letter by letter. But then it would disintegrate. So the question is, if you go to the next one, do we have generation one? Do we have the original Gospel of Matthew? Do we have generation two? Do we have generation three? How many generations have passed since we had the original? Okay, so that's the question. Now, let me give you a little sense of other writers in history so we have a context to compare the Bible. So if you throw the next slide up there, take, for example, Pliny the Younger, a Roman historian contemporary roughly with Jesus. 750-year gap between when he wrote his document and the copies we have today. 750 years. Take Caesar, 1,000 years, a millennia. Take Plato, 1,200 years. So if you put up there in the next slide, you can add just a little context visually. Click one more through there for me. If you have all these other writers and how far they are removed from the original, we often see 750, 1,000, 1,200, 14, 1,600 years removed. And yet most historians assume we can reconstruct those original with a high degree of faithfulness. Does anybody know what the time gap is for the New Testament? 200? Less than that. 70 years, less than that. Good guess. We have the original of Mark. In fact, no, I'm just kidding. I don't have it here. I'm just playing. If I had the original, man, that would be a scandal. Probably, click one more, probably within 40 years. We have a portion of called the John Rylands Papyri. Skip to the next one. We'll skip to that. From 130 AD. Some would say 120 AD. It's about the size of a credit card, and it's from the Gospel of John. Within probably 30 or 40 years of when John was penned towards the end of the first century. Historically speaking, this is pretty amazing. All these other writers that nobody questions. Do we even have anything for hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years? So that's why the next slide here, Dan Wallace, one of the leading textual critics, go ahead forward through that one. One of the leading textual critics in the world said, we have more and earlier manuscript evidence about the person of Jesus Christ than we do anyone else in the ancient world, including Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. We have earlier textual evidence for the New Testament and the Gospels in particular than all these other ancient figures that nobody questions. I know a lot of historical Jesus skeptics. I don't know any Julius Caesar skeptics. I know a lot of people who doubt the historical Jesus, but no one who doubts Alexander the Great. So my point is, if we just look at the New Testament through the lens of which we look at any other historical documents, we would be led to conclude beyond a shadow of a doubt that this historical Jesus and the stories therein are reliable and true. Now, the second part of the telephone test is this. It's how many manuscripts do we have? So how many handwritten copies do we actually have? By the way, a manuscript is either a piece of a manuscript or the whole thing. Okay, now, you guys tell me again, do we want more manuscripts or do we want less? We want more. Now, the more you have, what can you also have more of? You can have more differences, excellent, or variations between them. In fact, that was such a good point, I'm going to give you a free book. Nice job. Good catch. I have some more that might come out with good answers as well. Or money. Hold up money and not kidding. How many do we have? Now, let me give you some context, okay, of the number. Take, for example, Caesar's manuscripts. We have 10. Plato's tetralogies, 7. I mean, you can count that on 2 hands or 1 if you're Bruce Almighty. Tacitus, who's considered one of the most reliable ancient Roman historians. Much of what we know about Rome comes through Tacitus. We have 20 manuscripts from Tacitus. Some of the books of Tacitus have been completely lost to us. How many do we have for the New Testament? Does anybody know? How many manuscripts do we have of New Testament documents? Anybody know? Free book? 700, he's like, give me an exact number. Sorry, it's 742. Sorry, bud. No, I'm just kidding. Nope. No, you're guessing. That's okay. You're not too far. For the New Testament in itself, there are about 23,000 manuscripts. 23,000. Now, just stop and think about that. Tacitus, who nobody doubts, there's 20. Caesar, there's 10. The New Testament, 23,000? Over 5,800 just in Greek alone. Can you see how the New Testament is in such a different category than other ancient books? How different it is? Now, does anyone know behind the New Testament what book has the highest number of copies? What ancient book? Number 2 manuscript authority after the New Testament? What'd you say? Odyssey or the Iliad? That is correct, but you're not a student, so you don't get a free book. Good try. Anyone else? What's number 2? What is it? It's not the Odyssey. Who said that? The Iliad? Yeah, he was right. He just is a dole. He can't get it. You guys weren't listening. Do you have this book yet? Who do you want to give it to? Point to someone. Pressure's on. Ooh, good hands, man. Nice hand. This could get dangerous with the corners on these things. Number 2 book in history, the Iliad, with 1,700 manuscripts. That means the New Testament compared to the Iliad would look like this. Throw the next slide up there for me. Or the next one would look like this. 23,000 compared to 1,700 for the Iliad. That means the New Testament absolutely dwarfs other ancient books. That's why Dan Wallace wrote this. He said, the short answer to the question of what theological truths are at stake is none. None. That means if you just look at the Bible and study it the way that textual critics study all other ancient books, you don't even have to assume it's God's word. That means we can know, we can hold in its hand, because of how early it is and the number of manuscripts, that we construct the original with a higher degree of confidence than any other book from ancient antiquity, period. No other book comes close to the New Testament. Now, you remember when I was telling the story about the kids in the line getting my iPhone, and I said there's 300,000 to 400,000 differences for a book. Can anybody tell me, students, please, and I know a student is like, oh, I'm a student, what 80% of those variants across the manuscripts can all be categorized as? They're all a matter of what?
Language?
Language? Kind of close. No, but close. Rhymes with smelling.
Telling,
no. Spelling, nice job. He's like telling. Good try. Look, across these 20,000 manuscripts plus, there's hundreds of thousands of differences. 80% of them are spelling differences. You can spell John with 1 N or John with 2 N's, but you're still talking about what? John. Some of the debates are about the story of Jesus with the woman at the well. You know this story where he writes in the sand? Some of the earliest manuscripts do not have that story. So we're not sure if that was in the original or it was added later. There's some debate about that in John 7 and the beginning of John 8. But guess what? If that story was somehow in there by mistake, does that take away from the credibility of anything else that we have in the Bible and we know with confidence? Of course not. Of course not. The Bible is in a category of its own in terms of being a reliable and a trustworthy book. Now, let me close with the last one. I'll do this a little bit more quickly. But the last one is corroboration. Is there any evidence outside of the book that tells us the things in the book are really true? Now, just for a little context, who remembers how many archaeological pieces of evidence, by show of hands, there are for the Book of Mormon? How many? One? No. Huh? That's right. Not a single archaeological find. You can share it with somebody that tells us the Book of Mormon is true. Not one. When it comes to the Bible, there is an entire archaeological study Bible. I didn't bring it. It's bigger. It's like the two of these put together, and it's all the things they found in archaeology that corroborates the scriptures. Let me just give you a couple quick ones. I went to Israel two or three years ago. And when I got there, I asked a friend of mine who's an archaeologist. I said, look, I said, I know there's all these archaeological finds that support the Bible. Then I said, can you tell me the one area where scholars consistently say that the evidence doesn't support the Bible? He said, the number one story that I hear about is Jericho, about entering into Jericho. When Joshua and the battles of Jericho fall after the Exodus, I said, well, what do you think? He said, tell you what, I will take your group to Jericho and we'll take a look at it for ourselves. So I went, we know exactly where Jericho is. I've been there. And do you know in Jericho, in the 1950s, there was a lady by the name of Kathleen Kenyon who did a dig at Jericho. And she said, well, the Bible got it wrong by about a century. It's mistaken. And standard line in all of academia is the Bible got it wrong on Jericho. I said, well, what do you think? He said, let me tell you something that's interesting. He opened up the Bible and he pointed out what season it was when they entered into Jericho. Does anyone know? What season was it? It was harvest season. Now, why does harvest season matter? Because in the level of Jericho where it was destroyed, guess what they found? Shattered pottery full of grain. Now, when you destroy a city, what do you take? Food. Every time I destroy a city, I take the food. In ancient days, you destroy a city, you take the food. Why was there food, number one? Because it was harvest season. Number two, why was it left? Because it says in Joshua, they destroyed the city and were commanded to take nothing. That's an interesting hint. And then second, I don't know if you know what a tell is, but they would build cities on top of cities on top of cities. Megiddo, where Armageddon is, there's like 18 cities built on top. In Jericho, they built cities on top of cities. And he said, as you go down these cities, when you get to the time where Jericho was destroyed, guess what color all the remains are? They're black from ash. Why? What did Joshua do with the city according to the book of Joshua when he was done? He burned the city. Now, those are interesting clues that tell me maybe the biblical writers got it right. So my friend Joel brought back a world expert on Canaanite pottery, brought him to Jericho. The guy wasn't a Christian. He said, when would you date this based upon the pottery and does it match up with the Bible? He said he gave a specific date and he said it matches up exactly with when the Bible says that they conquered Jericho. The Bible got it right. I could go on and on about specific things that the Bible's gotten right. Here's just a couple quick ones. You know, the only evidence, who was the governor that crucified Pilate? Just kidding. Who crucified Jesus? Pilate. Not you guys are sharp. Nice job. Now, the only evidence for Pilate, it's getting late in the day, isn't it? You know, we're almost done. The only evidence for Pilate was literary evidence. Well, in 1967 in Caesarea, they found, this is a replica, they found an inscription that was written about Pilate governor of Judea during the reign of Tiberius Caesar. Pilate was a real historical figure. He really existed during the time the Bible places him. Look at the next one. This is in a town called Bethesda. It describes in John 5 how Jesus healed a blind man. And in the city of Bethesda, there were five porticos, which are like five porches, okay? Like colonnade structures. For years, skeptics said, this can't be true. The Bible got it false. Nobody built cities like this during ancient Rome or in Israel. Well, I'm standing over it right now, and the ruins below me, guess what you can see? I'll tell you what you can't see. I had a student do a presentation on this. She said, yes, they dug in Bethesda, and they found five porpoises. They didn't find dolphins, but they found five porches, exactly like John describes. Another one, a recent one, church tradition tells us that the apostle Philip went to Hierapolis, Turkey, and was martyred there. There is recent archaeological debate and reason to believe that they have now found the tomb of the apostle Philip. Interesting. Look at the next one. For years, skeptics said there's astonishing little evidence that the feet of a crucified person were ever pierced by nails. All the crucified victims we found had rope on them, and yet the Bible describes nails. Yet in 1967, look what they found. That right there, bones, I mean, look at the side of the feet, and that's the wrist with a nail through it. 7-inch nails in a tomb in Palestine in the middle of the first century. And like John 19:32 shows in the next slide, the legs had been shattered, confirming his legs were broken, confirming John 19, I actually think that should be 32, that they shattered the shins of the people next to Jesus, the criminals, to speed up death. What's the point? I'm amazed that people believe things like the Book of Mormon. It amazes me. They haven't found any city. They haven't confirmed any event. They haven't confirmed any people group. And they found evidence that contradicts it. You can go to Israel right now. You can go to the Sea of Galilee. I was there. And when I was there, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to walk on water because Jesus did. I walked on the water. No, I didn't. I'm just kidding. But I went on a boat in the Sea of Galilee. I've been to the place where Jesus was likely crucified. I've been to the place where it's likely where his tomb was. I have been to place after place where the events of the Bible took place. I have my friend Joel, who I was telling about, is an archaeologist there. I was asked about this, and he said, look, in Israel, people don't agree about anything. There's so much volatility. He said, but they agree about one thing, the basic storyline surrounding the person of Christ. Jews, Muslims, Christians all agree on that. He said, we laugh at skeptics who disagree because the evidence is right here in front of us. It's so compelling. I said, if the evidence is so compelling, why don't people believe it? He said, I ask myself that question every day, and all I can come to the conclusion is that there's a spiritual blindness that prevents people from seeing the truth. And that's why we pray, that's why we go out and speak truth, and that's why we believe that God can change people if their hearts are open. Amen? Let's take some questions, and then we'll wrap it up and get you guys out of here at least a half an hour early. While he's coming up to ask questions, I've got a couple books to give away. So let's see how well you are listening. Are you ready? First hand that I see. If you already have a book by free given to you or bought, you cannot answer. Okay? Are you ready? First hand I see. How many manuscripts of the New Testament are there? 23,000. Nice job. Your hand was first. Killing it. Okay. What is, give me the name, you may use your notes. This is for a study Bible. The crowd went, ooh. What is the name? Now that's the quietest you guys have been all day. What is the name? I'm going to look here because you look like you want to answer. I can hear everybody's hands. Of the earliest fragment we have of the New Testament. What's the name? I think your hand was first. Huh? What's the name of it? Oh, Dad is cheating. You already answered one. Go ahead. No. What is it? The name of the fragment.
The name of the fragment?
Yeah. New question, sorry. Oh, God. All you guys missed it. Too bad. Nope. Too bad. Too bad. New question. Too bad. Nope. Yeah, it was the John Rylands Papyri, 130 AD. Okay, new question. Here we go. Let's see here. Give me one compelling piece of evidence that we talked about of why we should think that the disciples are honest in what they write. Okay, your hand was first over here. It was behind, I think it was her. Okay, so give me an example of some embarrassing detail they report. All right, I will not throw this at her. Can you pass that down the way? We have one study Bible left, a hard copy, and we will wait till after the question time. Daniel, come on up here, my friend. We've got a few. He'll ask me one, check, and then I'll open it up if you have a question or two.
Okay, Sean, I have a question for you. What's your favorite color?
Oh, definitely red, even though I'm not wearing much red. For a couple of reasons. Red is Biola, where I went to university. That's their main color. So I just like red.
I love it. All right. Now, for reals now. We'll start out with the simpler.
That was for real, man. Now,
okay.
Okay, but go ahead.
Okay, I got you. I got it. All right. Somebody asks, what's an atheist's opinion after death? What do they think will happen to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me say something else from today I didn't mention. It's important to realize that not all atheists believe things exactly as I answered. There's a wide variety of people who are atheists who have actually a different belief system. So some atheists are called nihilists, and a nihilist is someone who says there's no life after death, there's no God, there's no morality, there's no purpose, you might as well just die. It's a depressing, angst feel about the world that says we're here by chance and we're going to go out of existence, you might as well die. There's existentialists that are more like Jim Carrey in the movie Yes Man, where it's like, say yes, seize the day, have fun before you die. And then there's secular humanists, and there's Marxists, and then there's probably atheists that are like the angry atheists. I mean, there's a variety, okay? So realize, don't think that every atheist is, number one, as thoughtful as I at least tried to be, and believes the same things that I believe, okay? But all atheists believe that when you die, you're done. Every atheist would have to say there's no life after death. They also don't believe in a soul, right? So you believe, and I believe, that when your body stops working, you stay conscious forever, and your soul will outlive your body. And I could actually give very good evidence for why I believe that. There's a whole chapter in Is God Just a Human Invention? No atheists believe that. You're not made in the image of God. God hasn't breathed life into you. You're just a body. So when you die, you are done for eternity. That's it. All atheists agree on that.
Awesome. Next question. Somebody wrote, in the role play, you gave a definition of a Christian's faith as putting God in where they can't give an explanation for something. They insert God. During the role play, there was a point where you were talking about the Big Bang, and you said that scientists couldn't explain how something works, so they came up with a theory to explain it. Yet they can't prove that. When an atheist does something like this, how do you address these kinds of things, since basically they kind of, quote unquote, are inserting God when they do this?
Okay. This is a good question. Let me give some background by asking a question. Do atheists have faith?
Yes.
Absolutely, they have faith. My atheist friends that I talk to hate that term. They hate to admit it. They'll say, no, I have confidence. I mean, it's funny. They just can't stand the word faith. Atheists have faith. Everybody has faith. I got on a plane yesterday. I put my life in the hand of some pilot I've never met. I put my faith in his hands. You drive down the road, you put your faith in all the other drivers you drive by that they're not going to swerve into your lane and kill you, right? You pick up water and drink it. I have faith that somebody didn't poison this. We have faith every single moment. So an atheist has faith that everything in the world can be explained without there needing to be a God. That's a step of faith. So this question noticed that I critiqued Christians for not being able to explain something and they would insert God. You notice what I did? I couldn't explain something. What did I insert? I inserted science. Science can explain some things, but science can't explain something from nothing. Can't explain fine-tuning. Can't explain the origin of life. It can't explain morality. And yet I inserted science into all of those things. So just like there can be a God of the gaps where somebody inserts God when they can't explain something, there can be a science of the gaps when they insert science into something they can't explain it. But by the way, I don't believe in God just because I can't explain certain things about the world. I believe in God because I think by looking at the lens, I believe in God because there are certain things in the world that only make sense if God exists. DNA, the best explanation is an intelligent agent. Fine-tuning the universe, I'm not inserting God because I don't have a natural explanation. I'm saying God did it because we know minds can fine-tune things. Okay, do you see the difference? I don't believe in the resurrection because, oh, there's just not a better explanation, so God must have done it. I believe in the resurrection because we have early, reliable eyewitness accounts of people who saw it, and they testify about it. Okay? So that would be my reason why. Excellent question.
Okay, Sean, this is a deeper question, a tough question. Let's see what you have to say about this. A woman wrote, 2 weeks after I gave my life or rededicated my life to Christ, I discovered I was pregnant. My daughter was born out of wedlock, and her father is not serving the Lord, but has always been a part of my daughter's life. He got married and had a stepdaughter. I discovered a couple years ago that my daughter was being molested by her stepsister from the age of 4 to 12. My daughter has been raised in a Christian home since birth, but has never really had a male role model in her life. My brother, who was her role model, passed away a year ago. My daughter is very angry and wants to know if God truly loves her. Why did he allow the abuse? My daughter is currently not serving the Lord and states she is lesbian.
So this, make sure I understand this. Her daughter was sexually abused by a girl, yes, not by a guy. Is that correct?
Right. That's how I understand.
That is really, really rare. You almost never hear that. That is interesting to hear if we have that right. Look, first off, oh, my heart just goes out to you, and I'm broken that you have to go through this and that your daughter has to go through this. I am so sorry. I've seen the pain that my father had to go through for 7 years being sexually abused, and I truly believe that my dad has moved on and forgiven the person, but every single day of his life, he has a reminder of what he went through. Every single day of his life. You know, I can't tell you something in 2 minutes that would fix this. It doesn't work that way. I think there's not a coincidence that this girl describes herself as a lesbian and experienced sexual abuse and brokenness from her father. There's a psalm that talks about we view our heavenly father through the lens of our earthly father, that we see God through the way that we see each other. And I think this is going on probably with your daughter. My take would be this is healing that needs to take place in her mind, but it's deep healing that needs to take place in her soul. I would do whatever I could to just build that relationship with her, to show love to her, to show grace to her, to show understanding to her, and also try in an appropriate way to pray for and find somebody who would be a male who would be an appropriate role model for her. Can't replace her dad, can't be a father for her, but I can help her to experience that unconditional love of our Heavenly Father oftentimes that comes through an earthly, you know, through a human being, a pastor, a neighbor, a teacher. And I would really be praying for God to bring that person, as sometimes it takes time. You know, the only other thing I would say is I shared my dad's story, how he was sexually abused for 7 years. Last year, my dad actually, for the first time, even though he's been in ministry 50 years, released a docudrama on his life. And a docudrama is like they have actors acting out the early part of his life, but then he'll splice in every 5 minutes and like explain it and talk about it. I think it was last year that movie Courageous came out. In a few of like the movie award things, the movie of my dad's life actually beat Courageous in terms of Christian films of the year. And I don't tell you that to like brag, like, yeah, my dad beat him, but to tell you there's a quality in this movie that sometimes is lacking in Christian films. And it's one of the first Christian films that dealt honestly with sexual abuse. And look, obviously it doesn't show it in an inappropriate way. I had my son watch it when he was 8. And then I explained to him what's going on, and I explained to him what happened and what happened to his papa. I've seen so many letters and people who have seen this. And my dad walks through how the man who sexually abused him, he actually goes and forgives this guy. And he did it in his life. And that's really what set my father free. So I might just encourage you to think about, it's called Undaunted, and it's a simple DVD. You could probably get it on Amazon or through my dad's website, which is josh.org. Get a copy of that and watch it, and then maybe show it to your daughter. Let her see it and talk about it. And it's pretty amazing to see somebody go through 7 years of what my dad did and really, through God's power, be able to forgive the man who did it by God's strength. And a lot of it was because a man mentored my father and lovingly, step by step, walked him through it and gave him the strength to do that. So I guess in sum, I'd say do everything you can to just love and encourage and show grace to your daughter. Pray and even look that there would be a man who would respectfully and lovingly be that role model for her. And think about getting a copy of Undaunted. The other thing I would do is, I don't know if you go to this church or where you go to church, but this is the kind of thing where I would try to just meet with the staff, and they're probably back there going, oh no, we can't deal with it. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sure they're sitting here at the staff saying, we would love to talk to you. We would love to pray with you. We'd love to be a resource with you. And they probably don't have simple answers when it comes to really tough issues like this. But I know having the wisdom that the pastors here and the other pastors that I've talked to have, maybe even connecting you with other moms who have dealt with this. You might be surprised. Other people in the church have gone through a similar thing and could just be a source of support and encouragement, and connecting you with them in that way could really, really make a difference. So thank you for sharing that. Oh, my heart is just broken for you. But one thing I know is that sometimes when there's the deepest amount of brokenness, that's when God can do the greatest amount of miracles. We worship a God of redemption, and that's what makes Christianity different. So please don't give up hope. Please keep going and just loving on your daughter, believing that God loves her even more than you do. Did you want to? Okay. 2 Corinthians 3:4.
2 Corinthians 1:3-4.
2 Corinthians 1:3-4 is a powerful. Thank you. Excellent. Go ahead.
All right. My friend has been having trouble with trusting in God, and I want to help her. I don't know how. How do I help her?
Oh, gosh. Here's why this is a big question. I don't know anything about your friend. I guess the first thing I would say is, if someone is having a trouble trusting God and this person is open to trusting God, I want to get to the source of why that person is having trouble trusting God. It could be a variety of things. Some people have a hard time trusting God in the Bible because they've just seen stuff on the History Channel and they don't think it's true and they don't trust it. Sometimes people have a hard time trusting God because they've been hurt, like this girl who was hurt in the past and sexually abused. The idea of a father that loves me, well, why would I want to trust a father when father represents to me someone who hurts me? It could be that. There could be a host of reasons why somebody has a hard time trusting God. It could be sin in somebody's life. Yeah, I'm a hard time trusting God because this is pretty fun what I'm doing right now, and I'm not sure I want to step out and trust God. So the only thing I would say is I would try to lovingly spend time with your friend and get to the heart of it and see what it is that's holding that person back from trusting God, and then find a way to meet that problem where it's at. A mechanic, before they can fix a car, has to find out exactly what's wrong with a car. Well, spiritually, there can be things that are wrong with us, and we have to find out what's holding us back from trusting God. With your friend, I'd make sure your friend knows that whether they trust God or not, you love them and you'll stand by them, and you're not going to judge them in that way, and that you care about them, and that you're not just trying to fix them on a project. And then if they're not willing to trust God now, when some pain or hurt or questions come up in the future and they're ready, they will turn to you and be willing to talk to you because they know you're a real friend and they see the difference God has made in your life.
Awesome. Last question.
All right.
So I think that everybody in here desires to want to be used by God, to just have this awesome life. I mean, we all have those friends who always just have these amazing stories of things that God did in their lives. What pattern, Sean, do you see in those kinds of people who are always just God's working in them mightily? You know, it's like there's got to be, is there a pattern? Like, what are they doing to experience God?
You know what? I'll tell you this. I grew up in a Christian home, and I'm guessing that's true for most of you. And I'd hear people share stories in church about, you know, I was a drug dealer and God transformed me. And I was in a gang and God transformed me. And I was in prison and I was thinking, man, like to be passionate about God, God has to do something amazing in my life. And it never occurred to me that I didn't want to be in a gang, do drugs, or be in prison. But I got the message that if God's going to use you, you have to have this radical, you know, thing happen. And it just wasn't my experience. And then as I grew up, I started to realize, like, wait a minute, maybe I can learn from other people's stories and the things they've been through. If I'm sitting here and waiting for God to, like, you know, flash a neon light in front of me and say, this is where I want you to go, this is what I want you to do, it's not going to happen. God's already laid out in the scriptures certain things that we should do. So when I was in college, I decided, you know what, I'm going to start a prison ministry. So I went with some friends every Sunday. We'd go to prisons and we'd bring this little book, More Than a Carpenter, and we'd start playing basketball with guys in a prison. And then we'd have a little Bible study with them. And they'd look for, when we were coming, you'd just hear them shouting like, ooh, white boys are coming, because we were all white. And we'd play basketball with them. And, you know, these are like 13 to 26 year olds, some in prison for rape and murder. And we got in there and they were just, I mean, they were like the kid next door. They were human beings trying to make sense of their life. And God broke my heart with it. So I guess what I'm saying to you is if you want to be used by God, don't sit back and just say, okay, God, use me. I'm available, which is a good starting place. Go do something. Even if it's small, go do something for the Lord. Talk to your pastor and youth pastor and say, man, this summer, what could I do? And it could be as small as saying, you know what? I'm going to go to a nursing home where there's older folks once a week. And I'm going to go read stories to him, and I'm going to talk to him. What a great thing to do. And I'm going to go pray for him. You do that once a week, you're serving God. Find out what are the needs in the church, what can I do? And you know what? That will cultivate a heart of servanthood within you. And then I think when God sees that and knows you're that kind of person, then more bigger opportunities are going to come along. So I just say, start with the things that are in front of you. Start with little opportunities, step outside of your comfort zone and serve, and all your churches and pastors will have practical ways that you can do this. And while you're doing that, you'll be helping people, but God will be shaping and molding your heart as you step out in faith. Look, it made me nervous to go into prisons and play basketball. I started praying more than I did. It's true. So just do it. Just step out and do, I mean, what can you do this summer? Maybe one day a week amidst the other stuff you're doing to show God's love to somebody. What a great use of your summer that'll bless people and would also start to change your heart and your character. And the other thing is kind of what we've talked about today. Start taking the Bible seriously. Study the Bible a little bit this summer. Study apologetics this summer. Go to classes and learn and go deeper in your faith. And then as you start to understand the biblical worldview, it's going to shape the way you look at the world. And hopefully, if you're trusting God, start to shape the choices and the actions that you make. So that would be my answer to that excellent, excellent question. I'm tired. I don't know about you guys. You're tired, she says, with no hesitation. Can I wrap up and then just give it over to you? Hey,